I'm going to start with State versus William Kane. If everyone participating could please step forward. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant Deputy Public Defender Kevin Finkenauer on behalf of the defendant William Kane.
Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey as a friend of the court.
Howard Pashman on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey as amicus. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant Prosecutor Patrick Aldeary for the state.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Finkenauer, please go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
When police saw Mr. Kane driving down the road, they did not see him do anything wrong. Nonetheless, when police saw him, they followed him, surveilled him, and upon seeing him have an innocuous encounter with another person, leapt out of their car to detain him. Before police may detain someone, as they did with Mr. Kane, they must have a reasonable, articulable suspicion that the person is engaged or about to be engaged in criminal activity. The plethora of our case law on the reasonable suspicion standard is clear that an ordinary interaction between two people in broad daylight in an ordinary neighborhood where the two people are not acting suspiciously does not provide a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. This remains true even if officers know one of the people observed has a substance abuse problem or suspects that one of the people involved may be a drug dealer. In support of its claim of a lawful detention, the state points to as supportive factors, one, assertions by unknown individuals from some undetermined point in time that Mr. Kane was selling heroin, two, the fact that prior arrests, the most recent of which was several years old, had occurred with Mr. Kane and Detective Guzman, and two, the fact of someone leaning into the car. Such factors, however, were not enough for detention. Accordingly, in my argument today, I would like to focus on the meager factors relied on in detaining Mr. Kane and why, even when taken together, they fail to amount to reasonable, articulable suspicion. This concludes my opening statement.
May I ask you to help us understand when the stop occurs in this case? I'd like you to walk us through the chronology, beginning with when the police get out of their car and approach the parked car in which defendant is seated. Just take a step by step and tell us, when did the seizure occur?
So the officers exit their vehicle, and Detective Guzman's testimony that he was that he was trying to essentially sneak up on Mr. Kane and Mr. Kocek and surprise them. So they advance towards the car. His badge is displayed. At some point, they get to a point where they're close enough where they are noticed. He says, police. They're startled. And that is the point at which the trial court found that the stop began.
What is your position? When did the police seize the defendant?
My primary argument would be that the trial court was correct, that the seizure occurred from the moment they saw the officers and were startled. And at that point, a reasonable person would not feel that they were free to leave.
The car moves forward a half a foot. Is that before, during, or after the seizure?
So that occurs after the seizure. They're startled, and then he pulls forward slightly, and then Detective Guzman tells him to stop.
The record is a little unclear on that. Is it your position that the movement of the car can or cannot be considered as part of the calculus?
My primary argument would be that it shouldn't be considered because it occurred after the point at which the stop started.
So as of the point of the stop, did the police pull weapons out?
No, they didn't pull their weapons out.
Did they block the vehicle in the way that the police car was parked?
No, they didn't physically obstruct them from leaving.
Did they tell the defendant, stop?
Not at the moment that they were startled. He said police, and again, they approached the car in a way, I suppose, that was intended to surprise them, which is indicative, you know.
So you have officers walking up to a parked car, announcing themselves as police with their badge displayed. What about those facts elevates it to a seizure?
So I would say it wasn't just that they were simply walking up to the car. His testimony was that they were kind of initially clandestinely approaching the car, and then at some point.
But the defendants don't see that. because this was an effort, as you said, at stealth. They were trying to surprise them. So what is it about the police conduct that elevates this to a stop?
So I would say at some point, you know, maybe halfway, again, the record's not entirely clear, they're close enough that they can no longer sort of remain hidden. And at that point, they say police, and it's, I would argue, evident from their demeanor at the time, probably based on the testimony of Detective Guzman and Detective Day.
Can you point us to anything in the record about their demeanor?
So Detective Guzman testified that it was his intention to effect a stop. And Detective De Jesus testified that as soon as he exited the car, he basically immediately went to go and grab and apprehend Kochak.
Is that the standard, what the subjective intent of the officer is?
No, but I think it's indicative of the way that the officers were carrying themselves. And officer demeanor is something that's taken into account when factoring a stop.
Suppose the officers put this case, the start of this case, suppose this began with officers simply walking by a parked car, looking in, with their badges on display, and announce themselves as police. Would that constitute a seizure here?
I would say generally if someone's announcing themselves as police, that would convey to an ordinary person that they are not supposed to go anywhere.
Isn't that what happens in an ordinary field inquiry, where police identify themselves at the outset many a time?
Well, I think there's a difference between approaching someone walking in a normal manner and saying, hello, I'm Officer So-and-so, and then kind of, you know, sneaking up on someone, surprising them, and shouting police. I think there's a distinction between those two.
Is it in the record that the police shouted?
No, he said announced. But again, I think based on the trial court's fact finding that, you know, the stop began from when they were startled, that there's implicit in that there was a certain aggression in the way they interacted with them initially.
I'm trying to get the chronology here. Did the police officer say stop before he made the observations inside the car?
Yes. And okay. That seems to be not disputed by anyone.
Okay. Well, that would be enough. See, when a police officer says stop, that command has to be obeyed. Otherwise, it constitutes obstruction. Am I mistaken?
No, that's correct, Your Honor.
So I'm trying to understand, like, why are you not pinning the point of the stop at the point where he says stop?
Well, my secondary argument would be that it's, you know, slightly immaterial whether it happened from the moment they're startled or from the moment that he said stop, because
we have jurisprudence, State versus Corley, State versus Williams, where we say that citizens have to obey a police command and take their problems to the court if it's an unlawful seizure and they can't take flight. And in this case, this is why I'm asking the chronology. When he said stop, is that when the defendant stopped the car?
Yes, I believe so. Well, I believe so.
So if that's so, then why is it not appropriate for the fact that the driver has this car move forward 6 feet be considered? You said that shouldn't be considered. The officer said stop after that moment. I'll ask you again, does that factor in, based on where you've now told us the stop occurred, into the justification, the alleged justification for the seizure?
So I think there's a couple issues with that. One is that if this is the sort of factor that's giving tipping weight to the reasonable suspicion, then, you know, obviously he was not free to leave before that. If he was free to leave, then he is able to drive away. And if he's not able to drive away, then obviously there must have been sufficient facts for a proper stop at that point.
I'm not sure where you are telling us the stop occurred. Was it when the police said stop, which makes sense, or was it at a point prior to that?
My primary argument would be that the trial court was correct, that the stop was when they were startled. But regardless, there was definitively a stop once he said stop.
Startling, this is where the Chief Justice was asking questions. That could lead to all sorts of subjective analysis. But the word stop has one meaning. It doesn't seem to be anything subjective about that. when it's uttered by a police officer. Do you agree?
No, that's definitely a very clear-cut issue of there was a stop.
And you're telling us that, tell me if I'm mistaken, that the police, that the defendant was beginning to drive away, didn't get more than 6 feet, at which point the police said stop, and the car stopped. And that, is that your chronology?
I don't know that I would characterize it as starting to drive away so much as he inched a few inches forward. But yes, that they were startled, and then...
Regardless of the startling, is it your position that he was, that the defendant was seized at the point the police commanded him to stop?
There was definitely a seizure at that point.
Okay. Yes.
And that, and Detective Guzman testified that that was before he observed the bag inside the car. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And he said, and I just want to clarify for the record, that Detective Guzman testified that it was only about a half a foot that the car seemed to inch forward. So not, it wasn't a long distance that the car had traveled. He directed him to stop and put the car in park. Then he saw the bag.
Right. He testified that it was consistent with someone basically lifting their foot off the gas pedal, perhaps inadvertently. But he only moved forward a very small amount. And then stopped, and then was stopped, and then there was a plain view of the heroin on his lap, which occurred after there was a stop, which, again, neither party is disputing.
And your basic position is they may have had suspicion, but they didn't have reasonable and articulable suspicion.
Right. I would categorize what happened there as a hunch, that the officer had a hunch that what he was viewing was a transaction, a drug transaction, but did not give any kind of objective basis on which that decision could be grounded.
Did the trial judge find that the stop and the plain view was essentially simultaneous?
So he said something to that effect, but essentially simultaneous, you know, they didn't happen at exactly the same time. There was some kind of chronology of, you know, when things happen moment by moment. And what definitely there is no finding of is that there was a plain view of the drugs before there was a stop. Before he told them to stop. And the trial court explicitly says that him telling him to stop happened, you know, a short while before, just before he saw the drugs. So there was definitively a stop before there was plain view. And with respect to the stop, it seemed to be the confidential informant tips that provided the primary impetus for why Detective Guzman believed what he saw was a drug transaction. Obviously, simply greeting another person and having had two prior arrests over a period of 4 years, the most recent of which, again, was several years ago, does not provide for reasonable suspicion.
With respect to the confidential informant, we don't have any basis of knowledge, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. We don't have anything.
And there's no information whether or not, in the past, that confidential informant had provided reliable information that has led to a conviction or anything of that sort, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Again, because the officer testified that he had no idea who these people were. He could not remember who they were. So if that's the case, you know, he's not able to give any kind of verifying information whatsoever about who these people are or why their tips might be reliable. The tip itself was bare bones. There was nothing within the tip that would give any kind of...
And your client was never convicted of a distribution or with intent to distribute charge, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Not even charged with one, I don't think.
No, there were two prior disorderly persons offenses that he was convicted of. Again, the nearest at that time was several years old at that point. And to protect citizens from these kinds of, you know, unwanted intrusions based off of these tips by anonymous accusers, our courts have scrupulously analyzed whether a tip was sufficiently reliable before
using
it.
That wasn't the basis for what was going on here. That may be one minor factor. It's according to the police officer's testimony, it didn't come out of the blue that he was following this guy. He knew him from two prior occurrences. He received this information, but that information, while it might be some factor of minimal impact, it's at least some factor.
Well, when
he didn't rely just on the tip, correct?
No, but when Detective Guzman was asked at the hearing why you stopped him and why you thought it was a drug transaction, the only explicit factor he could say was the confidential informant tips.
No, he also said what he observed, and based on his experience and knowledge, he thought he was watching a transaction.
Right, but there was no explanation of why what he observed.
Yes, there was.
Yes, sir.
He testified very specifically to what he observed.
But there was no test. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say there's no testimony that, you know, he had observed similar interactions in the past, that he'd seen drug transactions before where someone is driving their car and someone's not to meet them. He just said, you know, based on
a little more than meeting, there's a reach through an open window, is there not?
Yes, that's what he said.
Right. So it's not just two people who happen to meet on the street. There's somebody in a car, and there is a reaching by the person who approached the car into an open window.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I would say that's a completely ordinary interaction, unless there's some basis for believing.
We don't take each thing that the officer considered, dissect it, analyze it, and decide if that's enough. We look at everything he did, everything he saw, and decide if that's not probable cause, but just a reasonable, articulable suspicion.
Right,
that's what we do.
But the totality of the circumstances was that this was an ordinary street in an ordinary neighborhood in the middle of the day, that they were not looking suspicious, they were not furtive, they were not trying to hide anything.
That's not what he said. He said he looked startled and... I forget how he described it, but there was some level of concern that he discerned from the defendant's
right, but,
attitude.
But that was at the point where he already had left the car and was basically at their side with the intent of effectuating a stop. And
no, understood, but I'm just saying these are the factors that he considered in making his conclusions.
Right, but the only factor I think that really, again, I think Detective Guzman specifically testified that his intent was to kind of take them by surprise. So I think the mere fact the mere fact of their being startled is how any ordinary person would react if an officer testified that he came out of nowhere.
You agree that the totality of the circumstances test that applies to the reasonable and articulable suspicion standard requires that we look at all of these factors in totality, and that saying that one factor should not apply or is only weak doesn't dispose of the issue. We look at the entire picture of what the officer relied on.
Right, that's correct, Your Honor. And again, I would just suggest that the totality of the circumstances of what he was seeing at that time were wholly ordinary and unsuspicious. His primary foundation for believing what he saw was a drug transaction was only his prior experiences. But people who are suspected of selling drugs still go about their daily lives and do all kinds of ordinary things over the course of a day. So I think this is what the main takeaway from United States versus Drakeford was, because in that case you had much, much more information, you know, that the person actually was a drug dealer, but that still wasn't enough to contort an ordinary handshake into something that was a criminal enterprise, because nothing about those circumstances.
We're guessing. Tell me if I'm mistaken. The only thing that I see here is he's not under surveillance. They turn around, they park their car behind him. He's parked his car. Someone comes over and leans into his car.
That's correct.
And when they get out, police officers with the police, their badges emblazoned on their chest, the people who they're confronting are startled. Is there anything more than that?
No, Your Honor, not other than the, again, just general suspicion that he may be someone who is engaged in narcotic activity.
No, I'm just talking in terms of events, not what's going on in their head.
Correct, exactly, Your Honor. That's exactly it. And again, nothing about what was happening at that exact time other than, I think, even if officers knew for a fact that Mr. Kane was someone who was selling heroin, that still would not be enough to contort what they were seeing into reasonable suspicion for a drug enterprise, because there was nothing about what they saw at that time.
There's nothing about when they have prior experience with this individual. They have confidential informants saying that he's selling heroin. They see him in a parked car. A man walks up, reaches into the car. We don't have. I didn't see anything about an ordinary handshake. I don't think that anybody testified to that. There's a reaching into the car. And then there's the interaction when they come up and their reaction. That is just a whole series of ordinary events that should not have created any suspicion.
Well, again, I think once the officers are there and surprising them, it's contorted into something different. But before that point, no, I don't think that there's anything.
You've said now a couple times contorting. What does this mean?
Well, again, what I mean to say is that things are or. people who are suspected of selling drugs still go about their ordinary lives. And, you know, Detective Guzman did not know what he was seeing was a drug transaction. It was something that probably any ordinary person who saw it would think nothing of it. When I say contorted, what made that in his mind a drug transaction?
So if an officer doesn't know, and presumably if you're at a distance, doing surveillance at a distance, it's really difficult to know anything. If the officer doesn't know with 100% certainty that they've just seen a drug transaction, that's not a basis along with other factors for reasonable and articulable suspicion.
No, not at all, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting that at all. What I mean,
why is it important that he didn't know it as opposed to having a suspicion of it based upon what he observed?
When I say he didn't know, what I mean is that he needed some kind of objective indication of criminal activity that a court could look at and say, yes, you acted reasonably when you saw that and thought that was a drug transaction.
But that's not the only thing. It's not just seeing him reaching in the car. He also knew who this individual was from two prior drug-related experiences. He had this confidential informant, not enough, maybe of minor significance, but he told him he was dealing heroin. And, you know, that taken together is not just him seeing somebody reaching into a car.
No, again, there was something at all additional, but there was nothing that was really particularized to that moment in time.
Not individually, but collectively, we're talking about.
Well, again, I don't think even collectively, because everything was ordinary. Everything was typical. The street, the road, the time of day, even the manner in which they were interacting.
I assume the confidential informant that he mentioned is not typical.
Well, again, I would submit that that's entitled to virtually no weight.
It's entitled to something, maybe minimal, but something. Correct?
Correct. But
And his prior experiences involving drugs. One, he pled to a paraphernalia. The other one, he pled to possession. We have no idea from the record what he was charged with previously. But prior incidents involving drugs that this officer dealt with and what his observations were at that particular moment. We have those things. And the question is whether that's enough to be a reasonable, articulable suspicion.
Again, I would submit that it's not.
Okay, I get that. I understand. I didn't expect you to say, I think it is, and I'll sit down now.
Presumably he was not charged with an intent to distribute. I'm only saying that, and I want to be corrected if I'm wrong, because on page 20 of the transcript, it said that he had been arrested for possession of prescription drugs and for being under the influence and for heroin-related paraphernalia, arrested. Am I right about that? He wasn't arrested for anything else? Or am I wrong about that?
No, that's correct. I don't think there was any kind of distribution charges at all in relation to those prior arrests.
We don't have a record of that. They said he was arrested for. In the course of testimony, how these things are described is nobody offered a JOC, nobody offered a record, a warrant, whatever. Nobody offered any documentation. That's a statement in the record, which is of limited, minimal specificity. That's what you would say. We certainly knew. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, Your Honor, I think that the record is clear, at least when the officer describes the arrest, that they don't relate to drug trafficking, that they relate to drug use, which is something distinguishable.
About the paraphernalia aspect of it.
Of his prior arrest?
Prior arrest. Do we know anything about what that entailed?
From the record, I believe they said heroin paraphernalia that he was found with.
Could it be a scale or something along those lines? We don't know.
No, but this was, I believe, in his car. It was a DUI-related offense, and it seems from the context that he and the other person were using drugs. I think that's the kind of fair inference that you get.
They said the other individual had a needle in his arm.
That's correct, yeah. And again, even people who are involved in narcotics activity are entitled to go about their daily lives and will see friends and see family. And they can't be stopped every time they go down the street and meet someone else. And an officer says summarily, well, based on my training and experience, what I saw was a drug transaction, without more. And again, I think what's missing in this case that's clear is just, well, several things, but among other things, more robust officer testimony about why what he saw was a drug transaction, about why that to him, based on his past experience, indicated that it was the sale of drugs, which he was not able to do. Because that's what provides an objective basis for a judge to evaluate whether or not what he did was reasonable. To just summarily say my training and experience does not give any kind of indication of why what he observed.
Had the officer waited 60 seconds and had the fellow who approached the car taken his arm out with something in his hands, that would have been a different circumstance. Do you agree?
Correct, Your Honor. And a lot of the cases that the state cited where you have similar things where the officer sees somebody, it's an issue of you see somebody waiting on the corner, he's looking around, a car pulls up, he leans in. They don't necessarily see what's going on, but they end the interaction right there. The person drives off, and the officer follows them. And there you have much more than what you have here, because there is no way, one cannot know where the interaction would have gone unless one watched it conclude. And based on what happened at that point, that was not enough for reasonable suspicion of criminal activity.
Anything you'd like to add at this point?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Can I have one moment?
Of course.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I would just reiterate that I think the cases of Rosario and United States versus Drakeford, you have circumstances that are more suspicious than what you have here where reasonable suspicion is not found. And for the reasons articulated in my brief and made here, the decision of the appellate division should be reversed, and Mr. Kane's motion to suppress should be granted.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Shulman.
May it please the court, I'd like to start by reiterating the clarification that Justice Pierre-Louis made, because both Justice Albin and Chief Justice Ravner misspoke. The rolling was half a foot, not 6 feet. It was 6 inches.
I think that's what I said.
You said 6 feet, and then Justice Albin.
I said 6 feet.
You said 6 feet.
I meant 6 inches.
I think it is an important distinction because 6 feet bespeaks volition in a way that 6 inches does not. 6 inches really gets to just kind of an impulsive reaction of lifting one's foot and putting it back down.
It doesn't help the defendant in the analysis if the stop occurs after the vehicle moves a half a foot. Would you agree with that?
I think it's of little moment because it's 6 inches. I think had it been 6 feet, then we'd be talking about a Crawley-like issue where they didn't have reasonable suspicion, but perhaps the obstruction gets them to it. But I don't think 6 inches gets you to obstruction.
No, I don't. 6 inches, as long as they're not told to stop, people are free to go on their way. So whether he went 6 inches, 6 feet, or 12 feet, that would have been permissible until the time he was told stop.
Justice Albin, I agree with you. I think there is some imprecision in the record about when exactly he was told stop. But what we do know and what is crystal clear is that he is told stop before they see the drugs in plain view. And that's why there's not really a debate as to whether or not there was a stop. It is simply whether there was reasonable articulable suspicion. And I think—
Is there imprecision in terms of him being told to stop, not being told to stop, until he moves the car forward?
I think there is imprecision as to that. There is not imprecision as to whether or not he's told to stop before they see the drugs. He clearly is told to stop before they see the drugs in plain view. I think it would be useful to go back to first principles here when we think about field inquiries versus investigative detentions and Terry stops. The standard, as everyone has acknowledged, is reasonable articulable suspicion. And it's true, Justice Solomon, we look at the whole picture, we don't pick things apart, and it's also true when we do that, we can rely on, part of the analysis can be the officer's training experience. It can inform the reasonable articulable suspicion, but it doesn't forgive the need to articulate. So it is not the sort of thing where an officer can merely invoke my training and experience. This court has historically looked at what that training and experience is and whether it would lead a reasonable person to believe that criminal activity is afoot. So compare, for example, in Demeter, where they said, oh, in my training and experience, we had seen film canisters used to transport drugs versus Citarella. And they said, no, that's not enough. We don't think there's enough. Versus Citarella, a case that the attorney general cites, where they say, in my training and experience, people use bicycles to go across the George Washington Bridge to engage in drug transactions. Here, we just have the officer saying, it's based on my training and experience, but we don't know what. He says, he reached into the car, and based on my training and experience, that appeared to be a drug transaction. But let's be clear, he doesn't see anything in the buyer's hand or the seller's hand. So, of course, he doesn't have to see that it's an exchange of drugs for money, because that would be probable cause. But it has to be an exchange of something for something. It has to be something more than a wave or a handshake or something. And the officer did nothing other than relying back on based on the tip I had received and my prior experience with him. So Justice Solomon, you're right. Maybe there's something to it, but let's take a step back and look at the tip, because this is a tip that is entitled to zero weight in the analysis, because what he didn't know was who the person was, whether he had served as an informant before, the basis of knowledge, the veracity, whether they were a paid informant or not.
He did say he remembers it was an informant he'd used before and that he was reliable. I think he said.
But he couldn't remember who it was. So how did he
remember his name?
It wasn't that he couldn't remember his name. He didn't say, I remember the guy, I'm just slipping on the name. He couldn't remember the gender, like nothing. We know nothing. And so this court has never just taken officers at their word, because if so, they can invent informants and get to reasonable suspicion. I'm not suggesting that's what happened here, but that's why the requirement of needing it to be articulated is so important. And it gets back to a question of burden, because Justice Patterson, I don't think it was a scale. I think we have reason to believe that the paraphernalia at issue here was a hypodermic needle, but
I don't know. I was asking about that.
No, understood.
Was there anything in that paraphernalia that indicated distribution as opposed to personal use?
No, I take your point, and I guess my point is, in the absence of that, the burden is on the state. And so you're right, Justice Solomon. All he said was, well, I arrested him for possessing the pills, and maybe he ultimately did get charged with distribution or possession with intent. But that's the state's burden. The state has to articulate why it was reasonable to stop here. And what we have is, years ago, this person was involved in possession, not sale, of drugs. And I think my friend from the ACDL will talk more about what it would mean, what a rule of law would mean if that person, based on word on the street, because the tip is worth no more than word on the street, that he might be doing something, and then a totally innocuous hand into the car is enough to stop him. It means that anyone who has a prior drug use conviction, arrest, can be stopped in perpetuity no matter what they do. And that is something that is deeply offensive to Article 1, Paragraph 7.
Would make a credibility finding as to the testifying officer.
The trial court did find him credible. But I don't think that carries the day. That he's credible is one thing, but whether what he said was sufficient to amount to reasonable articulable suspicion is a conclusion of law.
Whether what he said was clear. For example, I got information from confidential informants that he was involved in this. And yeah, I can't remember the name, but I do remember somebody, and they found the officer credible in that regard.
So that is a finding that is entitled to deference, but whether or not that is the sort of tip that is sufficient.
Nobody's arguing it is sufficient.
No,
they're
I think.
They're just arguing that's one of the things that is considered in the totality to determine whether there's a reasonable and articulable suspicion.
Right, but it actually builds on everything, because when you look at the officer's testimony, when he explains why the otherwise innocuous hand into the car was something, he goes back to the tip. The officer says, based on my training experience and the tip, I thought it was a drug transaction. So without the tip, the house of cards falls.
And he indicated that there were several informants, correct, that gave him this information that defendant was involved in drug dealing. And he quite honestly testified when the judge asked, well, have you ever used any unreliable informants? And Detective Guzman said, yes, we have. But the ones we were using at that time weren't unreliable. I mean, so that plays a part in the calculus as well, that Detective Guzman can't remember how many informants it was, who they were, whether they were paid, whether they weren't at all, but seems to have an understanding that they absolutely were the reliable ones.
Right.
So that plays a part in the calculus as well.
It's a conclusory statement, and I think ultimately...
The trial court found him credible. I mean, we may have all the issues that Justice Pierre-Louis raises, but that's not what the trial court concluded.
And you don't need to find him incredible to find that his assertion that the person was reliable is a legal conclusion entitled to no deference. That's not a factual statement that he's reliable. That's a legal conclusion.
We've used them, and it turned out to be correct.
No, he didn't say that.
Sort of.
But not. I mean, sort of, but not. I mean, he said, I deem this person reliable. That's very different than saying based on his basis of knowledge and veracity, that's a legal conclusion.
To be clear, you're accepting as true everything that the police officer said. That's right. Not a question.
Agreed.
The question is, what are the legal conclusions that we draw from everything that he said?
That is 100% true. And so last piece on the question of are we looking at things individually or in total? Of course we look at them in total, but zero times anything is still zero. And so if each individual...
So are you saying that the tip should be given zero weight?
I am saying it should be given zero weight because there is no basis of knowledge and there is nothing on veracity that a reviewing court can look at and test. He just says he's reliable. That's not enough, and it's never been enough in this court's jurisprudence.
Before you sit down, everything happens quite rapidly here. We're talking about a matter of seconds.
Yes.
As you analyze the record, when did the police seize the defendant? Did it happen before the police said stop?
So the trial court found at page 102 of the transcript that it happened immediately before or simultaneous with. I take your point.
With what? With the plain view.
No. Everyone agrees this all happened before the plain view. There is no doubt but that...
So what was before...
Before he said stop.
At the end of your sentence. Before he said stop.
Was it the startling or the saying of stop that constituted the seizure? Those two things happened very close in time. And after both of those, they saw it in plain view. So, Chief,
all you need is to stop. If we're accepting the police officer's testimony as true, the one thing that we know from our jurisprudence is that a suspect is required to obey a command of stop, correct?
A verbal command of stop or, as in Rosario, a physical command with the car. I take Chief Justice Ravner's early in the argument questioning to get at the following piece. If we're at startle alone and before the articulation of the word stop, then in the calculus, you can consider the 6-inch movement of the car. If he said stop and then he rolled 6 inches, that's more of in the Crawley space. I don't think it changes the calculus one iota. I don't think it's clear exactly what happened. I take the question implicit in, or the point implicit in your questioning, Chief Justice Ravner, which is just saying police probably doesn't amount to a seizure, though I also agree with defense counsel that tone and timing can. But stop does. And stop, to Justice Albin's point, saying stop clearly it's the latest demarcation point at which a stop happened, and that is before they saw the drugs.
It's irrelevant that the car moved immediately before the word stop.
I think because it's 6 inches, I think he described it as half a foot, it is barely relevant, Justice Patterson.
Well, I mean,
you give this a zero as well?
No,
the officers identify themselves, announce themselves. I thought I'd said 6 inches, but that's the correct number. And the car moves before the police say stop. More than zero, but very, very little.
Exactly right. An iota.
I think that helps the defense. Before they announce stop, he feels he's free to leave and starts moving the car. I don't care whether it's 6 inches or 6 feet. Then when he says stop, he stops. He obeys the command. That's a seizure.
I don't think this is a close case for all the reasons
I'm trying to understand why you're slicing and dicing that.
Because the trial judge sliced and diced it and perhaps sliced it incorrectly, perhaps sliced
but
it correctly.
We have the facts here. We're accepting the police officer's true. Now we can draw our own legal conclusions.
I agree. And as I said, I don't think this is a close case because I think the informant tip is worth nothing, because the training and experience is totally not articulated as to what it means, and because even people with criminal pasts are allowed to lead law-abiding lives thereafter.
You also give a zero to the interaction with the man who approached the car. Is that also a zero?
No, I don't give a zero to that, Justice Patterson. I think, like in so many of the other cases we've looked at, take, for example, Myers and Naima, it is innocuous behavior that, without more, and here the dirty little secret here is, had the officer been a little more patient and waited a little longer, I'm not talking about minutes, I'm talking about seconds longer, he may well have developed reasonable articulable suspicion sufficient to satisfy courts. But he didn't. They jumped the gun, and in so doing, what they saw was an empty hand reach into a car. I mean, that's the thing. He said, I didn't see anything in the other guy's hand when he reached into the car. There aren't a lot of drug transactions that are something for nothing. And so he doesn't have to see what's in it, but he has to see something, and he didn't. And so
I don't think there's anything on this record that indicates he had a clear view of the hand.
He was asked if he saw anything in his hand, and he said no.
Right. Right. I didn't get the sense that he was close enough so that he saw the hand and would have seen whether there was cash in the hand.
But those are the things that police need to do if they want to articulate a reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot. Unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Pashman.
May please the court. Of course, I'm happy to answer any questions the court may have about the issues that have already come up, but being mindful of the court's time, I'll limit my comments to a few of the key points that have not yet been discussed. As Mr. Shalom said, some of the what I perceive to be, and what the ACDL of New Jersey perceives to be, the consequences of the appellate division decision. That decision would have really negative consequences that I fear go far beyond this case. The decision would allow the police to rely on uncorroborated rumors to target and stop those with prior arrests. And as I stated, that's a cause for real concern because tens of millions of Americans have now been arrested. In fact, I cite a study in my brief out of the Brennan Center in New York that indicates that there are now more Americans who have been arrested than have graduated from college. If, as happened in this case, the word on the street leads an officer to suspect an arrestee, then countless people who have been arrested before can and will be targeted and stopped whenever an officer decides to listen to a rumor. And so this ongoing suspicion and these repeated stops would be particularly harmful to people of color and other minorities. Again, I cite studies in my brief which provide the statistics showing that it's really indisputable that people of color, especially African Americans and Latinos, are stopped and arrested disproportionately often. Consequently, African Americans and Latinos are especially vulnerable when the police can rely on rumors to stop those with prior arrests. So this constant police suspicion would only exacerbate the racial and ethnic patterns in policing.
Mr. Pashman, can I come to where you began that by saying the appellate division opinion would have significant consequences? Published or unpublished opinion?
Unpublished.
And the analysis, as I see it in the appellate division opinion, is all of a paragraph on page 9, where if you take at face value what the appellate division has said, I wonder if it could lead to what you've just described. arrested and received information from a reliable confidential informant, actually plural. Set aside whether you agree with their finding, but that's what they have said. Placement of a hand in the window and a suspected hand-to-hand narcotics transaction. Again, you may differ with that conclusion, but that's what they pinned their decision on. Knowledge, startled, defendant attempted to drive away. Is it your position that an unpublished opinion that relies on those findings would have the consequences you've described?
I do. I do believe that. And I think if you look at the appellate division decision as a whole, as well as the facts on which the appellate division based that decision, you'll see that the record, which the court has discussed, is it lists all of those factors, but the officer testified that he decided to follow the defendant and to approach the car because of the confidential informant's tips and because of the two prior arrests. And so I do believe that, even though it is an unpublished opinion, and of course...
Could counsel finish his answer?
Did you finish? Had you finished your...
I just had one last point. The even though it is an unpublished opinion, I do believe, fear, really, that the decision would authorize the police to suspect people who had been arrested before based on the word on the street, which this court has previously found is just insufficient to support a stop. The word on the street essentially pointing its collective finger anonymously at someone who'd been arrested before. And that is what I fear the appellate division decision would authorize or permit.
So whether or not an unpublished appellate division decision would have the sort of apocalyptic concerns you're articulating is sort of immaterial now, because the case before the New Jersey Supreme Court, and what we say may have the sort of dramatic concerns that you're expressing now. Because whatever we do is going to be published.
It certainly will. And that's why I would ask this court to consider those consequences that I just outlined. Because without them, without bearing those in mind, I fear that the court may not make that point that Your Honor just mentioned. And so what I really fear is that this appellate division decision, if not reversed by this court, in an, of course, published decision, that it would essentially create, if not a rule, then at least a, it would at least kind of engender, create a belief that if someone is arrested once, then that person will very likely be arrested twice, or at least stopped twice. Because as the facts of this case suggest, if police suspicion and stops, prior police suspicion and stops, is allowed to lead to new suspicion and new stops whenever an officer thinks the word on the street justifies it, then that's the concern that I was referring to. And so that is, Your Honor suggests, it wouldn't be a rule in an unpublished opinion in a formal sense, but I certainly believe that, having practiced long enough, I believe it. You can be sure that the appellate division would be seeing that unpublished opinion cited to it, and perhaps all contrary opinion, unless properly addressed by this court. I mentioned...
Right. The appellate division would see its unpublished opinion cited to it?
I do. I do believe that. I mean, of course, it's not binding authority, as the rules suggest.
It's not supposed to be cited.
It's not supposed to be cited as controlling authority, but it can be cited with a copy and all contrary authority.
I don't even see, at this point, the relevance of this unpublished, because we have to make a decision.
Right.
And your point is, if we make the wrong decision from your perspective, that's going to have a dramatic negative consequence.
That's right. And I do believe, as prior counsel has indicated, all of the circumstances together, the totality of the circumstances, did not justify this stop. And I think that's the legal issue that the court needs to address head on, because all of the circumstances that that have been discussed, if you, the uncorroborated word on the street, the fact that the officer had arrested the defendant twice before, and the fact that a totally unknown individual walked over to the car empty-handed, I might add, on a bright July day. Now, this is not the idea that someone might be driving down the street with his window down and someone else walk over to the car is not suspicious, but for the prior tips, the confidential informant's tips, and the prior arrests, which again, I don't believe supported an objectively reasonable suspicion of criminal conduct. So the consequences, I believe, would be really dramatic if this court does not clarify that there are certain constitutional safeguards that everyone enjoys, regardless of whether they've been arrested before, regardless of whether they've been stopped before, and that those prior arrests, even coupled with rumors, even coupled with a stranger walking over to a car empty-handed and reaching into the car, do not provide a reasonable and articulable suspicion of criminal conduct.
Thank you, Mr. Pashman.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Galdieri.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'd like to start with a brief preliminary statement and hopefully address some of the questions that have already arisen in the course of that. In this case, the trial court correctly concluded that the state met its burden of showing that there was reasonable suspicion for the stop. And the trial court based that ruling on the consideration of appropriate and relevant factors and correctly analyzed those factors under the totality of the circumstances, without isolating each of them and analyzing them in a vacuum. And that's precisely the problem with the argument that there was no reasonable suspicion, is that that would necessarily require a divide and conquer analysis that analyzes each factor by itself and individually. And this case is a quintessential example of where the cumulative effect of proper factors that are considered each together are kind of more relevant and more probative of the reasonable suspicion finding that the judge made. No one factor was determinative in this case. Rather, it was a confluence of factors, and those factors included the first two things are relevant to kind of the subsequent things that I'm going to discuss, and that's that the detectives were specifically on undercover narcotics patrol here, and Detective Guzman had extensive experience investigating narcotic offenses. Specifically, he had been involved in over 1,000 narcotics investigations. And the reason those things are relevant is because in the course of what then he observed and what he knew, and applying what he knew to what he observed, he was more acutely aware of the things, of his perception of what was going on, and he was more observant. And the first factor that contributed to the reasonable suspicion finding was that the defendant had recently been arrested. Well, the first arrest was in 2011 for unlawful possession of prescription pills. More recently, because this stop was in 2017, in 2014 or 2015 is what the testimony was, the defendant was arrested for driving while under the influence of alcohol and or narcotics, and he was also found in possession of heroin-related paraphernalia, and his front seat passenger was actually caught in the middle of injecting himself with heroin. So we know that at that point, within the last 2 years, there was heroin in the defendant's car. And then that becomes very relevant here in conjunction with the multiple informants' tips that this defendant was distributing heroin in Perth Amboy. Because I have tips from confidential informants, multiple of them, that I know that I've used in the past that are reliable, and I'm seeing this defendant that I recognize drive by, and I know that he has been arrested with heroin in his car, in the front seat of the car, and also paraphernalia. As to Justice Patterson asked about whether there was a scale, we don't know the nature of what paraphernalia it was. We just know that there was heroin-related paraphernalia. And it's important that at that point, there's no elevated level of suspicion that the detective needed to follow the car and conduct this, further investigate, as he said. I mean, he was on narcotics patrol. He sees these things. He has a heightened awareness. He follows them. We don't need reasonable suspicion at that point, nor do I think that that's disputed. And then the defendant pulled over to the side of the road, and this is the other factor that then gets it over the hump, all things together, to have reasonable suspicion. Pulls over to the side of the road, third party approaches from the residences off to the side of the road, walks up to the car, and reaches in through the open window. I think it's at that point that where the detective certainly had reasonable suspicion to approach. And that kind of then gets me to my next point, which was there was this discussion about when did the stop occur, such that then the need for the reasonable and articulable suspicion is triggered. I think that is very clearly when the detective said stop. And this, the judge did find that it started, that he was stopped at the moment that the defendant and Kochick, the third party, were startled, which was right before or simultaneously when Guzman told him to stop the rolling car. I think that it did not start, the stop was not triggered at the point where they were startled. If that were the case, that would kind of throw out all of the law about an appropriate field inquiry. I mean, oftentimes people are startled. I don't think that by itself would mean that a reasonable person would not feel free to leave, although that is what the judge found. But I think it happened seconds later, like literal seconds later, 2 seconds after they were startled, which kind of happened as the car started rolling forward. And then the testimony is that that he instructed him to stop the vehicle because he had maneuvered forward. That also then answers another question here. There is a discrepancy in the record as to the Detective Guzman did testify that we approached, startled reaction, told him to stop, they stopped, saw the drugs, in that sequential order, all within seconds. But then there was a subsequent question, I think it was also on direct, where he was being asked about seeing the contents of what was in the car on the defendant's lap, and his response was, quote, once I observed that, I instructed him to stop the vehicle because he maneuvered forward. So once I observed that, he's saying there, once I observed the heroin, I told him to stop because he had been rolling forward. Be that as it may, the judge did find that the observation of the heroin in plain view happened after he, albeit simultaneous to, as the judge said, or within seconds of it, that the observation of the heroin happened after he told him to stop. And the state submits that that would be important that the stop did not occur until he told them to stop as they were rolling away, because although it wouldn't be necessary for a reasonable suspicion finding, it would add to the reasonable suspicion calculus, the startle reaction, and the moving the car forward, albeit only 6 inches or a foot. I don't think I have anything else to add right now, but I'd be happy to answer any of Your Honor's questions.
Can you cite to us a case with similar facts where no one sees either cash or something else being exchanged, where there is a background where the person is only arrested for DWI and possession of prescription pills and paraphernalia, and where there is a totally amorphous prior informant without basis of knowledge or any veracity? Is there anything out there that has supported a stop on what appears to me to be so little evidence? Go ahead.
Well, if Your Honor's not limiting the scope of those cases to New Jersey, there were a few cases.
Well, let's start with New Jersey.
I was going to get to that, but yes. Okay. State versus Arthur and State versus Pinero are kind of the two cases that would come to mind that, although they don't have what Your Honor's talking about. In Arthur, the guy got out of the car and he had the bag. In Pinero, there was an exchange of a pack of cigarettes.
And in Pinero, they had drug distribution backgrounds.
Well, that's, I think, kind of similar to what we have here, because in Pinero, it was intelligence reports that the defendant was distributing drugs.
No, but I think the people were arrested previous for drug.
And that's also similar to what we have here.
There's a difference.
Oh, well,
tell me if I'm mistaken, but between a possession of, being arrested for possession, arrested, not even conviction, for prescription pills or drug paraphernalia from distribution and possession with intent.
Well, I just want to make one distinction. It's not just drug paraphernalia. It's specifically heroin paraphernalia. Heroin-related paraphernalia, I think, is what the detective testified to. And he had the tips that they were distributing heroin.
And heroin was found in his car.
Heroin was found not only in his car, but in his...
He's not arrested for I'm just distinguishing between... There's a difference between distribution and possession with intent to distribute and possessing drugs.
It would be more probative if it was a distribution conviction, which would be more probative than if it was a distribution charge. And distribution is obviously more indicative of distribution than just possession. However, I think it's important that that doesn't set a threshold that the state or the detective needed to know that that prior arrest involved distribution.
I understand your argument. I was just asking you if there was a case with similar facts. There's not a lot here.
There's not a lot, I shouldn't say that. I do think that it certainly met the reasonable suspicion standard. I mean, that's the lowest standard we talk about, certainly in Fourth Amendment context, probably in all of criminal law, really. I mean, that's not a high standard. And then you also have to consider the intrusion, too. I mean, this defendant wasn't parked on his property. We're not talking about going into a home. He's on the side of a public street. The detective approaches. Presumably, if he didn't have heroin on his lap, he would have said, "What's going on here? Oh, you're shaking his hand. Have a good day." I mean, because then they wouldn't have searched. There's nothing to do that.
Even in two cases you cited, Arthur and Pinero, the police officers observed exchanges, correct?
Correct.
And as one of your adversaries suggested, during a surveillance, sometimes patience is counseled. Had they waited 60 seconds, they may have seen an exchange.
They may have, and in either situation, first of all, I mean, every case that I read from this court, published appellate division opinions, is careful when they analyze the facts. Even recently in State versus Alessi, says after analyzing Arthur and Citarella, and New Jersey versus Maryland, says, you know, each of these cases falls on a spectrum of permissible stops to impermissible stops, and that they rise and fall on the facts of the individual cases.
So how much weight do you think the court should give to the confidential informants?
I mean, I think we're talking about, some of your honors referred to like zero. Let's say on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being you can't consider this factor at all. That's like, you know, a race-based factor or gender. You can't consider it by itself. To 10, this is dispositive in and of itself of establishing reasonable suspicion. I think it falls somewhere in the middle. I don't think the judge, this isn't sentencing. He wasn't required to say, I give it great weight, I give it moderate weight. I think it was appropriate for the judge to consider it. To say that should be given zero, as has been mentioned today, I don't see how that can be the case, because an anonymous tip, the law is clear, standing alone isn't enough. The implication being standing alone, meaning it can contribute, it contributes.
We don't have any precise description, but these CIs are referred to in the plural.
Correct. I think that is clear.
I don't know whether that means two, three, or more.
Two or more, I think.
How much weight does that increase the weight?
I think it does, because we're not talking about, you know, I understand the skepticism about, well, how do we test the veracity and basis of knowledge of these informants? And that's a concern. However, it's only a concern if that were the only factor that the state were relying on. That analysis, basis of knowledge, veracity, corroborative events that ensue, that most of the time comes up in the context of probable cause, although it does come up in...
You have the burden. You could have asked a couple simple questions. Now, I'm not saying you, whoever was the prosecutor.
It wasn't me.
Do you know the basis of knowledge? Yes or no? No? Do you know the veracity? Any tips...
These are leading questions.
...result in convictions?
Maybe I'm reading those
moments. They could have...
Those questions could have been asked, and it would have helped, but they weren't necessary for that to be information that was appropriately considered by the judge. And the judge didn't find reliable informants gave multiple tips. The judge found unreliable, reliable. Word on the street was this defendant was distributing heroin. So I think that kind of is consistent.
But based on Detective Guzman's testimony, he didn't know the answers to any of those questions. He didn't know who they were, how many they were, whether they were paid, unpaid. He didn't know anything besides, well, during that time I was using reliable informants, so they were reliable, it seems.
Just Just the last thing that Your Honor said, he said, I know that these were reliable informants, the implication being during that time. I mean, I think that's similar to if I were to say that, whoa, I know one of my friends who I trust told me that, I can't remember who it was, but I know it was somebody I trust told me this thing. And I'm not saying that that would then make it dispositive in and of itself, but I do think it still doesn't prevent it from being relevant to the reasonable suspicion calculus.
Most of the case law deals with that as a solo.
Exactly. And not only that, but in the context of probable cause, which is a significant, well, it's substantial, moderately substantially higher standard than reasonable suspicion. And that's where Alabama versus White, which is quoted in Stovall, talks about how, like, the amount of things that are required in the reasonable, when the quote explaining why reasonable suspicion is a lower standard than probable cause talks about how the types of things that are considered as establishing that can be less reliable, can be in different forms that would indicate that they're not as reliable. And that's why that this was appropriately considered as just one of the factors. The state's not arguing that this would have been sufficient if the only factor was the prior tips from the informants, pull the car over with your sirens on. That's not what we have here.
Go ahead.
Can I just follow up? You mentioned the judge's comment, reliable, unreliable, but word on the street. Is word on the street enough?
By itself? Or is Your Honor saying, is it enough? I think it is enough if...
Can it be a factor?
It can be a factor.
Based solely on word on the street.
I think it can be a factor. I think the fact that it's somewhat of a colloquialism doesn't mean then that it shouldn't be considered, certainly. I mean, it's necessarily, he's making that finding on word on the street from informants information that were given to this detective, because that's the only word on the street that he could have been referring to. And the fact that he said reliable, unreliable preceding that statement, I still think it is a factor that contributes to the totality of the circumstances and then elevates the significance and meaning of the detective's observation of the hand-to-hand transaction he saw and the prior arrest's relevance to that transaction.
Let me just clarify something. You said earlier that once he saw the heroin, the car rolled, and I told him to stop. Is that the sequence you're describing?
I'm saying that the Detective Guzman testified at the bottom of page 16 of 2T. That is what his testimony was. Once I saw the heroin, I told the car to stop. He, prior to that, said the opposite, that he saw the car, he told the car to stop, and then he saw the heroin.
That was his testimony.
Both of those things. Point being, I guess, is the judge found these things were right within seconds of each other.
He also, when he looked in the window, I thought, maybe I have this confused with another case, he saw cash in his lap.
Correct, he did.
And that was even before he saw the heroin. First thing he noticed, I thought.
I don't know if it was before. I mean, that's like literally, it seems like that would be weird which way his eyeballs were looking. They were right next to
each other. What did his stopwatch say?
that we definitely don't know. I think this is an important, because, you know, if you separate each of these factors and consider them individually, they can each, other than the informant's tip, I suppose, can be explained away by an innocent explanation.
Assume this is the concern that's expressed by the defense. Assume the informant information is generalized as it is, and no one's seeing any hand-to-hand transactions. Just the person who's sticking his hand and his head in the car, right? That's what they're observing, correct?
They're observing him putting his hand in the car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In his head. The concern of the defense is Mr. Kane could be stopped every hour on the hour, every time he stops his car and some friend comes over.
I mean, I don't...
Based upon that information, because you've got... Because he's always going to have those prior arrests, and you have this sort of confidential informant stuff.
Well, an important fact that makes that not necessarily so is the detective did give detail when he was asked about when he was given these tips from the informants. He said they were fairly recent. And
okay,
he said they were fairly close in time to that date.
Any time that day, that week, hour, it could, every hour on the hour, some other police officer observing the very same thing would be able to stop him. Right? That's because some friend could be a friend, could be a brother, could be anyone, sticking their head in the car, stop.
Well, I think that one of the things that was discussed is that the detective's testimony was found to be credible, that's where the fact-specific things in this situation that might not necessarily arise in the future are that where on that road the defendant pulled over and how the third party, Kochuk, walked up and reached his hand in the car. And the informant's tips are important. That's why I'm not I'm not saying they should be given minimal weight. I'm saying that they are important to elevate
putting that aside, this for the moment, would you agree that someone coming over to a car and just putting their hand in, maybe their head in, standing alone, is fairly innocent stuff? Yes?
I mean, standing alone, it has an innocent explanation. Quite frankly, I don't know if I've ever seen anybody walk up to a car and just reach in through the window and shake somebody's hand.
No?
But that is a reasonable, I mean, you see discussions happen, but that is a reasonable explanation that could be given to that fact by itself.
But that's not the test.
That's not the test.
There are innocuous explanations.
Exactly.
That are observed is not the test.
The fact that standing alone would be innocent isn't really even important because you have other facts that make it not so.
The reason why I gave that is because the other stuff will always be there, which would justify a stop anywhere, anytime.
The informant's tips might not always be there. They're not going to always be. I mean, he said they were fairly recent.
Within a month, he said.
He didn't say within a month. He was asked, he was pressed on cross about what day, so you can say within a month. Can you say the day before? And he reiterated twice, fairly close in time, fairly recent.
What does that
mean? I understand. It is not specific. It is not as specific as I would hope when I'm reading through a transcript and preparing an argument, but that doesn't mean that it's not relevant and shouldn't be considered.
Yeah, but you can't even tell us what that means, whether it's a week, a day, a month, or 2 months.
I can't, but I can still say that not being able to tell this court doesn't mean that it's not relevant and doesn't contribute to the reasonable suspicion calculus.
He was being pressed.
It speaks to the credibility of the officer and the candor of the officer that he didn't just say, no, every informant I used is reliable and this happened the day before without it being the truth.
And he was found to be credible.
And he was.
What do you view as the significance of the car in motion for a very short period of time? But the fact is that it seems that the brake was released.
It seems that way. At first, the detective said that he drove forward, and then he was pressed on cross about, well, that kind of indicates that his foot was off the brake, and he didn't say, like, yeah, that's specifically what happened or not. The point is that as they were startled, you know, this all happened pretty simultaneously. The cops approach, they're startled, car moves forward, says stop, all within 2 seconds. And I think that's relevant because it shows, it kind of seems to be part of the startled reaction. I think it's reasonable for that to contribute to the reasonable suspicion inquiry because he started to pull forward and let his foot off the gas because he didn't want to get stopped because there was heroin on his lap and because he was interrupted in the middle of a heroin deal. And the detective did say, why do you think they had a startled reaction when he was asked on direct? And he said, it's because we were interrupting a heroin deal, which became apparent 2 seconds later.
Well,
I know that can't be considered, the fact that they saw the heroin. I'm sorry, Your Honor. But
thank you.
Is it okay?
For preempting my question.
Yes, I realize that. Probably forgot something, but I don't think it's certainly not coming to me right now. But unless Your Honors have any further questions.
Ms. Schwartz will pick it up for you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The Attorney General's interest in this case is to affirm that the proper reasonable standard looks at the totality of the circumstances and the whole picture, and the aggregate of everything that was in front of the officer at the time of the stop. Reasonable suspicion is a low standard. It's a minimal objective justification, and we look at the officer's expertise and knowledge and information at the time of the stop. In this scenario here, we have an experienced narcotics officer on surveillance for narcotics patrol. He knew defendant from prior arrests, one, knowing that heroin was present in his car. And because he was on narcotics surveillance, this court has said that element is evaluated in the officer's experience because that reaching into the car is given greater meaning when he's on surveillance patrol for narcotics. He knew that the defendant had a history of having heroin in his car and received multiple tips, which are self-corroborative of themselves, that he was dealing heroin in Perth Amboy, which we have testimony was only a 4.5 square mile city. and he witnessed what he believed to be a hand-to-hand transaction occurring. Officers do not have to wait for a crime to be completed in order to stop. And if you even just look at Terry as four reasonable suspicion stops, it was just a series of men canvassing a store and a seasoned officer of 35 years finding that activity suspicious. If there's no further questions, the Attorney General's office just asked this court to affirm the appellate division.
And what significance does the Attorney General attribute to the car being in motion for a short period?
I think it highlights how this stop happened in a few seconds. In fact, the detention here was only mere fractions of a second, as found by the trial court, and it goes into the totality and how we look at what the officer was witnessing at that moment and the objective justifications there. And since in that quick-moving series of events, the car lurched forward, ripped his hand out of the car, it all goes into what the officer was observing at that moment.
You've heard from your colleagues on the other side of the room that this case could have far-reaching impact, that people who happen to have had prior arrests could be routinely stopped on a constant basis. What is the Attorney General's response to that?
For reasonable articulable suspicion, it's a totality of circumstance test. It's a fact-sensitive analysis. So the affirmance of this set of facts that was present to Detective Guzman is not going to be present in every scenario. And it's a fact-sensitive analysis, so every case will have to have a look at what those factors the officer was looking at that point in time. So the prior arrests here were relevant because in corroboration with the tips that he was dealing heroin, the officer's prior knowledge of the defendant were building blocks into the reasonable suspicion here. So I don't believe that it will have far-reaching ramifications because it's a totality picture.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Finkenauer? Did you want to offer a brief rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try and be very quick. I just wanted to reiterate that reasonable suspicion is not simply more than zero, more than nothing. It's specific, articulable facts that give an inference of criminal activity. So we regularly have cases like Rosario, like Naima, and like United States versus Drakeford, where you have multiple factors that are contributing to why the officer did what they did, but you still don't have what equates to reasonable suspicion because they're paltry. So even if you have multiple factors, if these are, you know, assigned virtually no weight, then they're not going to total reasonable suspicion. In cases like Rosario and Drakeford, you do have tips where it's not just dealing only with a tip. You have a tip in conjunction with other things that are going on. But still, if that tip is not meeting the test that our courts have set out for analyzing whether or not it's appropriate to take it as a strong basis for reasonable suspicion, and you don't have other strong factors, then it's not going to amount to reasonable suspicion. And with respect to Pinheiro and Arthur, the two cases that the state quoted as the most similar, those are two cases where you have exactly what's missing here. You have Pinheiro, a cigarette pack is passed, the officer goes to the hearing and he says, in my experience, cigarette packs are used to transfer drugs. In Arthur, you have a paper bag, the officer says paper bags are used to transfer drugs at the hearing. There is no kind of testimony like that at this hearing. There's very little testimony at all about why he did what he did, other than summarily saying, based on my training and experience, and based on the totality. But again, it can't be only buzzwords. There has to be an objective record of why this amounts to reasonable suspicion. Unless Your Honor, is that any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter.